night on Arena. Solace Through Cooking with My English-Persian Kitchen, a Picasso exhibition, comes to the National Gallery of Ireland, and Swan Lake at the Cork Opera House. You can text us on 51551, of course, arena at rte.ie is the email address for the programme, and we are on Instagram at rte_arena, which will be a little bit useful for you later on, and I'll tell you about that. What do you do when you have an hour to leave your own country and start over again somewhere you don't really understand the language or the people? The play My English Persian Kitchen tells the story of a Tusa Saper who fled Iran for London in 2007 and now lives in Belfast. When she first got to England, she was alone. She'd left everything behind and she was suffering from homesickness and loneliness. One way out was to learn to make the recipes of home, including a dish that she calls Osh, and which Isabella Nafar, the actor who plays her, makes on stage during the show. My English Persian Kitchen is coming to the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire and the Lyric Theatre in Belfast next week. And I'm delighted that Atusa Saper joins me now in studio. Welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the first things, Atusa, that your character says in the play is, Iranian women like me don't cook, you see. So who are Iranian women like you in this play and why don't they cook?
That was one thing that I really wanted to include in the play, because when I came to London and also Ireland as well, many people, when they found out that I'm Iranian, the first thing they were asking me was like, can you drive in your country? Do you study? The view they had from Iranian women was so different from the reality. 80% of graduates coming out of university are women, not men, in Iran. And they're very successful. They go to work. They are actually work as hard as a man, actually harder, because they need to prove themselves as well, because it's not as easy to be a woman in Iran as it is to be a man. So that was one thing I really wanted to show in the play.
Was that a preconception that it took time for other people to overcome when you came to the UK and to Belfast first?
Yes.
You had a very successful business in Tehran and your family was there and your friends. So at the beginning of this play, we find out that you had to leave. Why did you leave firstly? And then why did you only have 1 hour to get out?
I had to leave because I knew I'm not going to get the divorce. And in Iran, unfortunately, the man has the permission. Only the man can grant you the divorce. So I knew if I asked for divorce, which I had, I would have not got it. So I had to find a way to get out of that marriage. And in order to do that, I had my own business, which was import and export still. And what I did, I reached out to one of the companies I was working with, not explaining anything, just asking if they would need someone like me in London. And thankfully they did. So they applied for my visa, they applied for everything. Only when I knew I have everything sorted, I asked for my divorce and he was like, no. But I left home, went with my parents back to my hometown, which was Esfahan, which is like 6 hours from Tehran, where I was living with my ex. And because I wanted to get to know again my friends, because it was been a long time, because of my relationship with my ex, I was neglecting everyone, not be able to be in touch with them. So I was trying to see them before leaving. But exactly the day I got to Esfahan, I received a phone call as I was sitting out by the river with my friends that you need to come back. Why are you not coming back? And I said, I'm not going to come back. And he said, okay, you're not coming back? When he found out that I'm serious, he said, I'm going to ban you from leaving the country. And I knew this is not a joke, because he was working in a place that was all the passport, everything, all the information, he could have access to them in a second. So that was the moment I called my mom and I said, Mom, this has happened. And my mom said, okay, you need to come back home and we need to get back again to Tehran.
It's an extremely tense sequence at the very beginning of the play when it occurs. Maybe talk us through that, because there is this 1 hour window in which it is highly possible that if you hadn't have managed to have made it there, that you wouldn't have made it out of the country at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We got to a car after getting money from friends and family, because at the time there was no ATM in Iran. And the tickets would have been very expensive, the last minute ticket. And I wasn't even sure if there's going to be a ticket. My mom drove all the way back to the airport, which was 7 hours. And she passed all the traffic, all the lights, the speed lights, and she got so many tickets. Then she told me about it. But she didn't care. She wanted to get me back to Tehran and to the airport. Luckily, we got the very last ticket. I'm not exaggerating. I remember when my dad came and said, "We have it." And I went to the check-in and I left. Only when I left, it was 6 o'clock. But in Iran, the companies start working from 7. It was only at 7 that I got banned from leaving the country. And straight after that, my parents receive a phone call that, in a way, like, you know, Atousa has been banned from leaving the country. My dad was like, "Okay, it's fine."
How did you feel on that flight the first time out? Because presumably you're at a point whereby the fear inside you says, "Well, the plane could turn around at any moment. I might not necessarily make it to my destination."
I didn't feel like that, to be honest with you. When I look back, I don't even know what I was thinking. Everything happened so fast that it didn't even let me to contemplate and understand what is happening. On the plane, all I was thinking was like, where am I? What's going to happen from here onwards? Does it really mean I can't go back home? It just was a very strange feeling. I was completely lost.
As we find out in the play, you make it to London. Starting again is obviously very hard. You don't know anyone in London. So how do you go from there to realising that you need to make these recipes to remind you of home?
I felt very low for the first time in my life, because when I was in Iran, I was holding my shape. But when I came here, I lost it. And I was every day I was going lower and lower. And looking back, I was suffering from depression at that moment, that time. So when I was coming back from work, I didn't know what to do. And the only thing that slowly made me get back to myself and helped me to survive really was food. Because that was the only thing that when I was experiencing even a small dish, because I didn't know how to cook. That was the problem. I didn't know how to cook. So even smell of something from Iran, it was taking me back home. So I realized I need to start cooking. I need to learn and make my mom's, my grandma's, my own dishes and feel I'm at home. And that's how I started calling my parents, my mom, my grandma, my aunt, and learning the recipes one by one and going through them and making them.
Okay, the play that we're talking about, My English Persian Kitchen, it comes to us from the Soho Theatre in London, and it starts with your character making a certain dish in her London flat. Tell me about that dish and about what is in it. And is it one of those ones that's a firm favourite in Persian cooking, or just something from your family?
No, it's a very, very common dish. Everybody would know about this dish in Iran. You will find it everywhere. You can go to this, when you are on the street, you can buy it like ice cream. People, they just serve it in a bowl and give it to you, and it's delicious. It's a kind of a soup, but it's a very thick soup made with loads of herbs, beans, loads of spices, and noodle. And on top of it, you get a kashk, which I couldn't find. So I mixed sour cream and feta cheese, which taste quite the same, and one of my cheats, and caramelized onion, garlic, and on top of it, mint, which is the oily mint, and also saffron.
How many versions of that did you have to go through in order to get it right? Was that a long process?
Many, many. That was a hard one, yes.
The actor, Isabella Nafar, is actually cooking on stage during the play. The audience gets to smell it while that's happening, and then they get to taste it at the end. Is that important to you?
Oh, yes, very much. Because as Hannah Khalil, the beautiful writer, always says it, we could have not create all those smell and not give the audience the chance to try the food. It's just not Iranian, and not, she's half Palestinian, half Irish. So it doesn't go well with our culture. So we had to find a way for audience to try the food as well.
It must be unusual. What is it like seeing an actor play yourself on stage, and then what is it like seeing audiences react to your story, possibly without realizing that you're amongst them?
Yes, people don't know it's me, and for me, I'm still learning to watch it without getting too emotional. I'm still finding it hard to relive it, and with audience, I'm getting a little bit more comfortable because I can see they're enjoying it. In the beginning, it was very hard. In the beginning, all I cared was looking at audience and see how they are perceiving it, how their reactions are, and if anybody's going to leave or if they like it, what's going to happen in the end when they try the food, do they like the food? So, yes, it was very interesting. Once I was sitting there and a lady next to me, she said, oh, I came just to learn the recipe. Do you know the recipe? I said to her, I wrote it. And she said, oh, okay. Oh, what? Did you write it? It's nice to sit next to the audience and them not knowing who I am and just look at the reactions.
But in seeing somebody play yourself as well, that must be a strange, almost out-of-body experience.
It's very strange. I'm still trying to get used to it. It is.
You ended up with so many recipes in the notebook from those initial phone calls home that you wrote a best-selling cookbook, From a Persian Kitchen, in 2018. How did that happen? What is the step between you just collecting those recipes because you were feeling homesick and all of a sudden you have a book in your hand?
It was a very sudden decision for me. One of those decisions I made, because when I came to the UK, I started studying chartered accountancy as well while I was going to work and cooking. And it was always me trying to do the things that I thought is the right thing to do, trying to prove myself, trying to be equal to a man. And at one point, I just realized I'm not going to carry on doing that. I'm just going to do what I want to do. And I left everything. I remember my boss's wife said to me, are you mad? Why are you going to do this? Just write, if you want to write the book, write it. But you don't need to leave everything behind. But it was a decision I made. And it took me a couple of years to get the book together because I did the photography of the book myself as well. I tried to learn it. I didn't know how to do photography. So having the book, it was something that completely changed my career as well. Because after that, because the book was perceived very well and it got so many rewards, I received a phone call from the publishing company asking me if I'm going to write the second book. But I didn't want to write another book just for the sake of it. So I went back to college, working with food for so many years and getting so close to it. I wanted to learn the science behind it. So I went to college for 3 years and I became a nutritional therapist. And then after that, I became a registered nutrigenomics practitioners, which is how food impacts our genes. So I went very deep. And then I made a conscientious decision that I am going to dedicate my work helping people that they are suffering with chronic conditions with food. And over years, I built up a practice, which is quite good. I am very happy with it, very vibrant, working with clients with so many different conditions. And it all came from me letting myself to explore what it was inside me, but I always kept it suppressed because I didn't want to be associated with the woman in the kitchen. But
So how does the play come about then? Because, you know, the route from cookbook to West End stage isn't necessarily the most obvious path, is it?
No. When the book got published, there was some stories about my journey coming to London, which was published by Guardian newspaper. David Lough, the creative producer of Soho Theatre, read it and got in touch with me. To be honest with you, in the beginning, I thought, like, is it a spam? What is this? Is it true? Is it right? So I went and saw David at Soho Theatre and I realized, no, it is really true. And it from there, it took a long time because then COVID happened. And there were times that I thought, it's never going to happen. It took 5 years to get it to where it got. And during the COVID, I met Hannah about a couple of years after we had the conversation with David, Hannah Khalil, who, as soon as I met her, I thought, that's it. I want to work with this lady. And we had so many, it was on the Zoom. We had so many meetings and we went through everything together, and she had her first draft and then the second and third. So many drafts came out of that.
You live in Belfast now. How did that happen?
Looking for slower way of living, to be honest with you. London is great, but everything is so stressful and fast. But Belfast, everything is slow motion, which is I love. And We always wanted to be in Isle of Ireland, and coming to Belfast was one of the best decisions we did. People are very nice, extremely nice. I never felt this welcome anywhere since I came to this part of the world, really.
Does it make you slightly nervous knowing that the play is going to be playing in Belfast and therefore possibly in front of people that you know, people that you've met, people you live close to?
I feel like it's, despite being in Belfast just for 3 years, I really feel it like it's my home. So I feel like I'm in a way, I'm very happy it's going to be in my home, being shown to people in my home. And I hope they're going to enjoy it as well.
Atoussa Sapir, thank you for talking to us tonight.
My pleasure.
Arena.
Thank you so much.
My English Persian Kitchen is at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire on the 21st and 22nd of October. It's at the Lyric in Belfast on the 24th and 25th of October as part of the Belfast International Arts Festival. Further details, depending on where you'd like to go, at paviliontheatre.ie or at belfastinternationalartsfestival.com. And you're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. A newly opened landmark exhibition at the National Gallery of Ireland features the remarkable works of arguably the single most transformative artist of the 20th century, one who is now also regarded by many as one of the most controversial. Pablo Picasso lived surrounded by his art, his personal life and his work, his homes and his studios were always intimately linked. A new exhibition, Picasso from the Studio, allows us to explore the artist's life and art, drawing from the collection of the Musée National Picasso Paris, with the addition of two works from the National Gallery itself. Art historian Jess Fahey has visited the exhibition in recent days and she joins us this evening on Arena. It's the 50th anniversary of Picasso's death in 2023, Jess. There's been much discussion about him and the events and the exhibitions in recognition of his work. So why does he continue to be one of the most celebrated artists in the world?
Well, this is one of the things that's so fascinating. And I think this exhibition does a lot to help us make these, I suppose, points of discussion and topic and talk about it. I think one of my favourite quotes about him, it comes from Dora Maar, his once partner, who was an extraordinary surrealist artist in her own right. And she said of Picasso, she said, as an artist, you may be extraordinary, but morally speaking, you are worthless. So I think that's something to sort of bear in mind when we think about him, because you can't avoid that controversy these days, but there is still no denying just how significant he was as an influential artist in the 20th century, arguably one of the most influential, in particular if we're looking at Cubism. So if you think of even the changes that happen in art in relation to Impressionism, various different movements in Post-Impressionism, Fauvism, these different ways of re-examining technique in art, what the Cubists do, and this is Picasso along with George Braque, is they go further than that and they actually change what art is meant to be or what kind of meanings can be conveyed in art. In particular, if we think about the first form of Cubism, which we usually date to around 1908 up until mid-19-teens, this is called analytical cubism. And in that instance, what they're essentially doing is trying to understand an object more perfectly, more authentically. So Braque describes this as you break it down into all of these different component pieces and then rebuild it so that you know it as well as you possibly can know it. But Picasso talked about it a little different, and I think it might be an easier way of understanding it, particularly when we think about what Cubist works look like and they're kind of as if they're shattered or broken up. He said what you're really doing is painting how you think about an object. So rather than what most artists have done prior to Cubism, which is if they're looking at a bottle, they paint the bottle. The technique or style might be different, but they're still arguably looking at the object. Or even if they're imagining something, they're basing it in this sort of way on making it as realistic looking as possible or naturalistic as possible. Whereas Picasso wants to think about how do you convey the way we actually see objects in our head? Now, I am aware of the fact that not everyone has a visual mind, which is quite a new revelation to me, but not everyone does. But usually if you say to a person to think of a violin, you can think of that object and you can think of the curve at the top. You can think of the cutouts at the front, the strings, the wood, the way that it might cast a shadow, or depending on how your brain jumps through those different images of the violin, you will have multiple things going through your brain, not just one perfect view or perfect image. So this is really what they were trying to do in the first form, which is analytical cubism. And then the second form, which is synthetic, is instead of it just being about how we think about an object, they start to think about, well, what does it mean if you add in different elements to your painting, including pieces from the real world? So they're playing with reality, playing with time. You'll have collages that have cutouts from newspapers, or in fact cutouts from the cane on a chair, all of these sort of things.
And part of Picasso's reputation is that obviously that entirely changes the nature of what art is, and ultimately then changes everything that is to follow after that as well.
Yeah, hugely influential. And it actually, it's nice that this follows on from the Mani Gellert and Evie Hone exhibition that we had recently in the National Gallery, because we can see how that works in an Irish context. But arguably we wouldn't have abstract art without Cubism. It may have come about in other ways, but it comes about really through, essentially a straightforward link. So we have to think about it as this true revolution in art. Not only that, even if that was all he did, that would be important enough. But he had a career where he created over 50,000 works, and all of those in a completely, progressive or moving, not necessarily always in one direction, but a career where he looked at different ways of creating, not just in terms of subject or technique, but even in terms of materials. And this is over quite a long period of time. So his influence is just undeniable.
The volume is an important thing, and the length of career is important as well, isn't it? Because for a lot of people who have spent any time in any modern art gallery anywhere in the world, there will be usually a major or minor work by Picasso there, or two or three or four or five, depending on where you are. It's kind of hard to avoid him.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, again, indicates how important he is as well, because it's very hard to tell the history of 20th century art or tell the history of modernism without having a work by Picasso included. What is interesting, I think, in relation to this exhibition is that it comes from one particular collection predominantly, which, as you mentioned, is the Picasso Museum in Paris. They have about 5,000 works by him. And these were works that he had kept himself. So there's something very interesting too in looking at which works an artist sells, which works get into public collections early, which ones they keep, why they might keep them. He once said that he was the greatest collector of Picasso in the world, because that's just one Picasso museum that came from his private collection of his own works, and actually, interestingly, also works by other artists. But there's one in Malaga, there's one in Barcelona. So even as you're talking about individual museums having individual pieces, there's also full museums of just him.
Okay, well, let's dig into this particular exhibition then, because it represents, as you say, about 5,000 works that are part of the original museum that they come from, which is still just a fraction of his work throughout his life. There are paintings in this exhibition. There are sculptures, ceramics, works on paper, photographic, audiovisual works as well. But what's special about them, as you've already alluded to, is that these were the ones that he didn't sell on. These were the ones he didn't part with. And they moved from place to place with them, didn't they?
Yeah. So the exhibition is arranged room by room, roughly in relation to each of these important studios that he had. And when we say studios, that sort of suggests that these were separate workplaces. But actually, he tended to live and work in the same place. Although possibly due to the many mistresses, he would sometimes have separate entrances or secret ways of getting in. But this is to be expected, as we know, with Picasso. So yes, the exhibition then brings us from, you know, the earliest one is the Bateau Lavoir, which is a very famous building in Paris, which had originally, I think it was like a piano factory and had a ballroom in it. But by the 1890s, it was turned into these very small little rooms that artists started to rent out among other people. And it was known as the Bateau Lavoir, which is the washing boat, because if it was very stormy at night, it would creak and sway so much, the whole building would sway. So this is a very, unglamorous start for someone who becomes as famous as Picasso. But what's fascinating about it is that you see when he chooses places later, he tends to like that same type of grandeur of building, even though it's not the derelict one anymore. And people have sort of guessed that maybe it's something to do with the idea of that's when he had his coming of age as an artist. Because, of course, he's a Spanish artist, but he moves to Paris in 1904. And this is where he stays in France for the rest of his career. So that first room shows some of those cubist works that I was already mentioning. And then it moves room by room through different places and different spaces, showing you how the artist studio impacts what an artist will make. So, for example, when he moves to Bois-Galeux, which is this manor house in Normandy, he has these outbuildings, these huge outbuildings. So he starts to make big sculpture because he has the space to do it. And it always makes me think of the artist Lee Krasner, who was married to Jackson Pollock, and she painted on a very small scale and he painted on a large scale. But it was because she was using the spare room and he was using the barn. And then when he died, she took over the barn and got bigger. So these things are important in terms of the decisions and choices an artist makes. Literally the space they have indicates what they can do.
Because you might not think of that very often. People frequently think that an artist's studio is a studio. It is the place where they just so happen to be making the work that they're making at that stage. They think of it as just a physical room where the art is created. But frequently it defines the sort of art you're making. It defines the size of that art. It defines whether or not you will be able to make art.
Yeah, it really does. We can think of Francis Bacon's studio, for example, in the Hugh Lane, that shows you the way that not even just the space, but even the different decisions an artist might make in terms of geographically, where are they, what view they're looking at, what the climate is, elements of whether or not they want a building that has character or they want something modern or updated. Often artists strive for north-facing windows because they want the light to stay the same throughout the day. So those kind of considerations. In his case, and this is one of the great things about the exhibition, is there's so many photographs of his studio spaces, is that he was very particular about how the objects were stored in the individual rooms. And they were objects that were works that he made himself, that he was holding on to. And often he kept his sculpture, incidentally. But also he would just pick up random objects as he walked around. In one instance where his studio and his living space were across a field, as he walked across that field, whatever he picked up, he'd bring to the studio, and that might inspire what he made that day. You know, famously, there's examples of a sculpture by him that's the saddle of a bike and the which is the face of a bull, and the horns are just the handlebars of the bike. So that was just something he saw and brought along. Again, unsurprisingly, from what we know about his character, he got very annoyed if anybody moved anything or even dusted anything in his studio. And he once said that the way an artist arranges the objects around him is as revealing as their creations. So it's really fascinating.
Tell me about his ceramics period, because it's one that people might not necessarily be familiar with, but does fit into that quite nicely, because he took up ceramics because of the location of where the studio was.
Yeah, so at this point he is on the Côte d'Azur in a place called Vallauris, and in Vallauris he's there from 1948 to 55, and that is a known pottery town. So as soon as he's there, there's all of these factories, the smoke billowing out of the chimneys, and he gets exposed to this as an art form. And it's always been something that the Cubists and other modernists were interested in, was to sort of question that hierarchy within art as to why is it only painting and sculpture that are considered fine art or high elite level art, whereas other materials could be equally. So he takes up ceramics, and within a few years, he makes about 3,600 pieces, an extraordinary number. And it's believed that he was actually thinking about this as a way of commercializing his output so that he would be able to make works that could be sold to more people and arguably cheaper, so that you didn't have to buy a painting, you could buy a ceramic. But what I like about the ceramics is they tend to be more humorous. There tends to be a sort of playful nature with how he works with shapes, for example, what he can turn, you know, a jug into an owl. And he had a pet owl, in fact, called Ubu, which again is a, you know, softer side of him that we don't necessarily talk about as much. But he was able to take an art form like that and turn it into something that expressed himself and do it really prolifically, as I've mentioned.
Later on, he moves again and again, but there seems to be always be that eye back towards the early locations and the early studios that he seems to not be able to quite get away from. I think the phrase that's used is the fetishization of poverty.
There's an element of that, I think, that artists tend to have. So, and this is more of a 20th century thing. It's that sort of sense that an artist is best when they're struggling. So his days of struggle were his days living in that sort of, you know, rat infested, falling down building. And there's always a potential to romanticize your youth, I think, anyway. So there's those sort of ideas of this being a time of greater freedom or greater ability to find expression, because he wasn't being looked at, he wasn't being examined. I think, though, there's something with Picasso that ego screams so loudly often, that maybe there is also just this case of him keeping these works around because he was as, you know, interested in his own works as he was ever going to be in anybody else's. And potentially that inspiration coming from, you know, ideas of what he had when he was younger, we'll never know for sure. But again, this exhibition at least leads you through how those objects continued with him and those spaces changed, and his artwork as a consequence changes over time.
And I meant to mention earlier, if you would like to see some of the pictures, some of those are on our Instagram at RTE_arena. You'll find them there. In the latter period of his life, he heads for the sun, though, doesn't he? It's almost a retirement setup for him.
Yeah, as many people do, in fact, yeah, understandably. But it isn't a retirement at all. In fact, he is arguably more vital, more invigorated and more brash as an older artist. His later paintings are some of the, you know, most confronting, I think, in many ways, certainly the most sexually charged. And a lot of our own expectations of what we expect of an older artist is completely destroyed by looking at anything Picasso did later in life. And it seems as well that part of that experience of moving to the south of France and living in that climate also, you know, I think, I suppose, in a way, can be sort of seen in a kind of brighter viewpoint on life, perhaps, as well. Although, as I say, I interpret it differently, but I'm sure he found great pleasure in those types of images. But that was, I think, again, part of this, rather than retirement, this reinvigoration that he experiences later in life. And he's very prolific in his last years as well.
He's an increasingly troubling figure as time goes on, particularly with regard to his relationships with and his attitudes towards the women in his life. Tell us about that.
So this is one of the things that's become, I think, a very important part of how art is displayed and talked about today, not just in relation to Picasso, but there had been a very secure tradition of considering the male genius as this sort of untouchable person. Even he used this as an excuse in his life where, you know, he can get away with things. He can go outside of the boundaries, outside of the rules because of who he is. And that has just been for such a long time being accepted. So thankfully, in more recent years, we've had exhibitions, particularly those, you know, during the commemoration of 50 years after his death in 2023. And they revisit it through a different lens. So it's not the, you know, idea that we should get rid of him or never look at him again, because that also causes problems too. We need to confront that this is part of our past, that this is arguably still part of our present, and that we have to, I suppose, reinsert those stories, or at least not be afraid of telling the true stories of what it was like to know Picasso, to love Picasso, to live with Picasso. Even his granddaughter at one point talked about the only thing he was a genius at was upsetting and harming the people around him. And I think these conversations are vital, and they don't necessarily even, I would argue, take away from his art. I think they can just allow another avenue of exploration, but one that doesn't brush it under the carpet or gloss over it as had previously been done.
Does this exhibition address that in any way?
It does, by the inclusion of portraits of women in his life. So you're bound to want to know who they are and to ask those questions. And it isn't difficult to find those answers. So the various different women, including someone like Dora Maar that I mentioned the quote from earlier, she's included both in a portrait that he painted of her. I mean, the Cubist style is unflattering anyway, but he seems to have gone out of his way to be unflattering to her.
I don't think anybody's ever flattered in a Cubist portrait.
No, definitely not. It might depend on how you feel about yourself in the first place, but definitely with her, he seems to go further into almost the potential of annoying her. She did once say that she didn't sit for any of these, that they are not portraits of her, they're portraits of him and how he viewed her, which is a different thing and very interesting to consider. But thankfully, some of her artworks are included. So there is one of the digital video elements is a series of her photographs of him making Guernica, which was something that she was commissioned to do. And this is an extraordinary record of arguably his single most important work. Certainly, I would say, from my experience of, you know, seeing his work, the most impactful and the one that you never forget seeing once you see it. It is, you know, this extraordinary, you know, work that gives you so much expression of pain and of suffering that we witness in war. But because it is abstracted, it isn't, even though it's based on one event, it isn't just about that one event. It becomes much more universal. But seeing her photographs shows you the way that he painted, that he worked. And there's something really intriguing about that relationship that they had with each other, which ends up being really quite awful. But the argument often was that he would, you know, be with these women who are artists and he would encourage them. In actual fact, it seems to be mostly the opposite, but at least she managed to get something of her own artistic creativity in this exhibition, but also generally more talked about these days.
And that's before we address his reputation as a cultural appropriator. Do you think that's a fair description of him as well?
Yeah, I think the thing about it, though, it is pretty much all artists of this era. And if we're looking, you know, 1850s really onwards from the opening up of trade with Japan, and we see so many artists, you know, Vincent van Gogh and Monet and loads of others being influenced by Japanese art. And it depends on where you draw the line between influence and appropriation. Certainly in relation to Picasso, even the term we use in terms of his African period is it's often called, we use the term primitivism, which is problematic in its own right. But it is, as they saw it, a complementary thing. They meant it as a rebellion against the kind of arid stuckness of the Western world to something freer, more liberated. But although those influences are important and we need to understand them to understand Western art, they are still and increasingly problematic.
In terms of this exhibition then, Jess, just to finish, what overriding impression of Picasso and his life and his work do you feel that you were left with after you'd seen it?
I think hoarder would be one, for sure. But also just an endlessly curious mind. So you get to see that one of the reasons why he has this long career and created so many works is that everything seems to be inspiring to him. And maybe sometimes we do get stuck in the personal life. And there's examples here of just how anything he could see or pick up or look at. And I mentioned the owl as a ceramic jug, or, you know, these ways that the world was just so inspiring to him. And I think that even if you don't like him as a person, can be an inspiring thing to experience when you visit an exhibition.
Art historian Jess Fahey, thanks so much for joining us tonight on Arena. The exhibition is Picasso from the Studio. It's open to visitors right now and it continues until the 22nd of February next year. For more details, you can go to nationalgallery.ie. And next month, Jess will be giving a presentation at the National Gallery of Ireland, which will relate to the Picasso exhibition, but with greater focus on the practice of Irish artists in their studios. You'll find more general information about Jess and her courses and her lectures at jessicafaheyarthistorian.com. Derek Mahon is widely regarded as one of the most gifted Irish poets of the late 20th century. Gallery Press, in association with the University of Notre Dame, is marking the fifth anniversary of his death with a special event at the Royal Irish Academy of Music in Dublin on the 4th of November. Guests will include Claire Keegan, Paul Muldoon, Elaine Ni Cuilenán, Stephen Ray and John Banville. You'll find more details about that event at gallerypress.com. One of Derek Mahon's best-loved poems is Everything is Going to Be All Right. It's a poem that went viral during the pandemic. Let's hear it now, read by the poet himself.
Everything is going to be all right. How should I not be glad to contemplate the clouds clearing beyond the dormer window and a high tide reflected on the ceiling? There will be dying, but there is no need to go into that. The poems flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. The sun rises in spite of everything, and the far cities are beautiful and bright. I lie here in a riot of sunlight, watching the day break and the clouds fly. Everything is going to be all right.
And that is Everything is Going to Be All Right by Derek Mahon. For ballet dancers, Swan Lake is the iconic work with the iconic roles that most professional performers can only aspire to. It was first performed by the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow in 1877 with limited success, but revived successfully in 1895. And in the intervening 130 years, the imagery, the music and the tragedy of the piece have merged so much with the culture that for many, Swan Lake has come to define what classical ballet is. Cork City Ballet is gearing up to stage Swan Lake at the Cork Opera House next month. I am delighted now to be joined by the artistic director of the company, Alan Foley, who's in our Cork studio. Alan, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thanks, Rick. Lovely to be here.
You've been staging Swan Lake on rotation with other classic works, the likes of The Nutcracker and Sleeping Beauty. So how does your interpretation of Swan Lake differ from traditional productions that people may have seen before?
Well, it doesn't differ that much, Rick, insofar as all of the elements of Swan Lake are there. The full corps de ballet, the soloists, the principals. However, what we did do, I made a decision with the choreographer, Yuri Demikov, who trained at the Bolshoi, to bring a happy ending to our production of Swan Lake, because I just felt that there is so much tragedy in the world at the moment, you know, with wars and famines and starvation and everything. And the original ending of Swan Lake is very tragic, with both the leads, the Odette, Princess Odette, and Prince Siegfried committing suicide, throwing themselves into the lake and killing themselves. And I thought, no, I don't want that. I want people to leave the theatre, you know, feeling good and, you know, just to be carried away by the beauty of the story and the costumes and the sets and, of course, the magnificent score and, you know, the age-old evil, our good overcoming evil. So we changed the ending, myself and Yuri, so that Rothbart, the evil magician, is gotten rid of, and Odette and her prince live happily ever after.
And how do you make that change practically? Because obviously you're in some way constrained by the music.
Not really, because the music is there, the entire score is there, so you just decide what it is. It's particularly it happens at the end of the ballet, so the finale, where you have that big rousing dramatic da na 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 na, that particular piece of music. So Yuri and myself just changed it, because that is the part where usually Odette just can't take any more, because she has, you know, she's just utterly distraught. So she throws herself in the lake, and then the prince throws himself in after her, because he can't live without her. So Yuri and myself just sat down and wrote the choreography the way we wanted it, to come to this happy conclusion.
I mentioned at the very beginning of this piece, the ballet wasn't particularly well received in 1895 when it was first performed, was it?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the very, very sad things that not many people may know is that Tchaikovsky died not knowing that his ballet would go on to become, in my opinion, the most iconic global sensation that it has become. Because, as you said earlier, the original production in 1877 was not good at all. And the revival, it was only at the revival after Tchaikovsky's death that people sort of said, oh my God, wow, this is incredible. And then it just went on to, you know, become the iconic ballet that it is today.
You have a small amount of flexibility with the music, as you said. So mostly the flexibility is to do with the choreography. Or are there always certain beats that you have to hit in Swan Lake?
Oh yeah, oh absolutely. I mean, the score is, it's not a complex score. It's easy enough to dance with. It's very melodic, which is one of the things I love about Tchaikovsky and his music anyway. But I mean, there, you know, all of the elements are there. Like, you've got the corps de ballet, you've got the, you know, their waltz, all of their lament scenes in Act 2 and Act 4. We call them the white acts. Then you've got the very famous signets, which are the four girls, which are linked together, which again, a lot of people may not know that this particular dance looks pretty simple, but it's actually one of the most difficult dances in the entire repertoire of classical ballet, because you're relying on three other people being pulled right and left and up and down. And of course, the whole thing takes place on point, as we know, which also sort of makes it, you know, 10 times more difficult. And then you've got the princess Odette / Odile, and the prince, and then all of the other elements around that as well, surrounding that. Like, there are some children in the ballet in the waltz in Act 1, for example. And all of these things together, combined with, you know, stunning costumes, beautiful sets, and, it, you know, all of this is wrapped up in Tchaikovsky's magnificent score.
Tell me a little bit about the dancers that you're working with in this particular production. You have a married couple involved this time. What sort of energy does that bring to the show?
Tetso Ivanov is a principal dancer with the Sofia Ballet in Bulgaria, and his wife is the prima ballerina, Katerina Petrova. She's the prima ballerina of the company, and I mean, they're two world-class dancers. I mean, they're magnificent. They've been with us a number of times before. Last year they did the Sleeping Beauty with us, and they did the Nutcracker with us as well. I mean, you know, they're at the top of their game. They're stunning. It's great for all of the dancers in the corps de ballet and our soloists to see this level of, you know, stunning dancer coming to Cork. And we're thrilled to have them back. I mean, the energy that they bring into the studio when they arrive, because obviously they know the ballet. They've danced it many, many times. So they literally come in a few days before we open at the Opera House. And we, Yuri and myself and our ballet mistress, Pat Crosby, we slot them in. They're a joy to work with, an absolute joy.
And how do you cast your corps de ballet? Is that a much longer process?
That is a much longer process, yeah, because we get hundreds of applicants from all over the world, and we have a very international cast. We've got dancers from, this year alone, we've got dancers from Japan, America, Italy, France, London, or Russia. It's amazing, the variety of dancers that we have working with the company.
For yourself, what's the most rewarding part of preparing this particular production?
Swan Lake is one of those ballets that, you know, essentially sells itself. We always sell out when we do Swan Lake, always. It's just something, everybody loves it, everybody's attracted to it. For me, the most important thing and the thing I love most about my job, Rick, is when I manage to get people to the theatre to see the ballet for the first time. And if I meet them afterwards and they say, I can't believe it. I can't believe that I have never been to the ballet before. I never realised the ballet was like this. Because a lot of people are under the sort of illusion that ballet is just the preserve of the privileged. And that drives me bonkers. Because it is, at the end of the day, only dancing. Yes, it is a very stylized form of dancing. And, you know, ballet dancers train from a very young age for about 8 years to become professional ballet dancers. It's high art. There's no doubt about it. But it's high art for everyone. And it should be. It's only dancing. It should be for everyone. And, you know, when I hear people say, oh, I don't know, isn't that for the hoi polloi? No. No, it's not. It's for everyone. I mean, I'm not posh. I don't come from a sort of a posh family. And, you know, the people that I work with, I try and work with people who, like everybody that I employ, I'm very conscious that they all want to be part of a team to make this happen here in Cork for the Irish public. So, yeah, that would be the greatest reward for me.
I'm conscious that at this point we've teased people enough with it and actually not played any of the music from it. Let's just take a little bit from Swan Lake. This is from Act 4. It's the Entr'acte, it's the Lament, and it's the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the great André Previn in 1976. And a little something people might be less familiar with from Swan Lake. Alan, I wanted to ask, you're a dancer yourself before you took on the role of artistic director of the Cork City Ballet. Do you miss the dancing part of it?
No, Rick, I don't. I don't miss it at all. Not that I didn't enjoy it when I was doing it, but it's very, very tough. It's very tough on the body and, you know, the rigors of, you know, leotards and tights every day, standing in front of a mirror, you know, doing the same thing. Ballet is very repetitive. You've got to take class every day of your working life. And it can become very, very boring. So you have to love love that difficulty, because your body is like an untrained horse, you know, that just wants to rebel all the time, and you have to get it under control because, you know, to make it do what it is that you want it to do. So, no, I don't miss any of that. But that said, I feel very privileged that, you know, I was able to partake in a profession that I absolutely loved and felt very passionate about. I feel very lucky about that.
And just briefly, what do you hope audiences will take away from this particular performance of Swan Lake?
I hope that they will be inspired to come and see the ballet in future and just know, you know, that ballet is for everyone. It is only dancing at the end of the day.
Alan Foley from the Cork City Ballet, thank you so much for talking to us
tonight.
Thank
you, Rick.
On Arena. Swan Lake opens at the Cork Opera House on Thursday, November the 6th, and runs until Saturday, November the 8th. There's a matinee on the Saturday at 2:30. For tickets and information, visit corkoperahouse.ie. And that is Wednesday night's Arena, produced by Sinead Egan. Paula Shields was our researcher tonight, broadcast coordinator Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision by Tommy O'Sullivan. I'm Rick O'Shea. Tomorrow night from 7, we'll have another Arena for you, and John Creedon is next after the news.